The following program may contain content that your kids would love to hear, but you may not want them to.
Frank Cotolo. He just talks and 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 talks.
Okay, here we go.
Listening to Frank Cotolo.
Okay, here we go.
Listening to Frank Cotolo.
And now the host of our show, and others. It's night, everyone. Time to go down the Hallelujah Trail with the Godfather of Internet Radio, the Bard of Broadcasting, the third man, me. I am also the original Internet of Things. Things being one of the three descriptions of a noun. I'm a people, this is the place, and this is the Internet of Things. My name is Frank Cotolo, man whose name adorns the title of the show. Don't go away, 2 hours of acting lessons, almost 2 hours, with Michael Laskin and I. Right, from Ice Cap to Ice Cap, from Hamlet to City, from Othello and into every bordello. Two Shakespeare references in that opening, which is the way, except for once or twice or three times when I completely screwed up, that I always begin this show. Not a program. There is nothing programmed here. This is completely off the cuff. It is unedited and it is everywhere. It is live on Thursday nights, as I am right now doing it, but it will be recorded, of course, and available on many stations. Go to the blog, Frank Cotolo. No, it's not Frank Cotolo. That's not the blog. That's the Facebook. The Facebook. CotoloChronicles.blogspot.com. And where else? Everywhere else. Look, just Google the name, Frank Cotolo, and all will be there. It's always been there, 8,432 references on the Google spider. It's not, and by that I mean there's not that many. But what's the difference? There is no difference. Here again, we made it Y2K plus 17, and I'm really excited about tonight, because it's not just me hammering the words and the thoughts out. It's me under the guidance of Mr. Michael Laskin. Michael was on before, not before, like, you know, a couple of minutes before. I mean, a while back, when Charles Dennis was on, and how I know Michael, through Charles Dennis, who you know has been on this show a couple of years here and there, and we'll be back, I promise, but busy man. He's writing, he's producing, he's directing, and being an all-around great guy. But Michael Laskin starred in some of his stuff, but Michael Laskin, I may add, because it's my show to do whatever I want, I'm adding right now to tell you The Michael Laskin, you're going to know a lot. You know, he's one of those guys, a great actor, and he's one of those guys who you will see in many movies that you watch and TV shows. Holy Christmas. Where do I give you the menu of this thing just to give you some credits? But also, Michael is, and you know, he's one of those Michaels that you just can't call Mike. Do you know what I mean by that? I think you do. I know I do. And he's one of those guys that, and a great character actor too. And you say, like, what's the difference between a character actor? In any event, in all events, and certainly in this event, he has written a book. It's a great book. It may be one of the greatest books on acting ever. And I don't know many others, so I could say that, right? The greatest book. I don't know him. Who is the famous? We'll find out from him. Who is Stanislavski? Maybe him. But he's going to talk about some. He's going to help me. We're going to do some stuff acting because I'm a horrible actor, and I'll tell him the story of that too. The book is called The Authentic Actor: The Art and Business of Being Yourself by Michael Laskin. And that's really a confusing thing to me. How do you act and be yourself? Because the self you're portraying is not you. So right there, I have a problem. I don't think it's a semantics problem. Do you? I don't think so. I think it's a concept problem with me. And maybe they're all concept problems with me, right? Is that what you're saying? My name is Frank Catolo, the man whose name adorns the title of the show. We're here again in January. This is the 19th of January. I think there's only one more Catolo Chronicles until next time. If you're listening, and I know you're listening, if you're hearing me. No, if you're listening, you know, you shouldn't say no. You shouldn't just go no. And no less say it a number of times. I am on this journey, my friends. I'm on this journey from the beginning of this show back 15, 20 years ago. And now I'm still on this journey to leave. Hear that? That was a, well, boy, that really did something to the graphscape, soundscape. To continually speak as well as I can in full sentences and not do things like go, no, yeah, yeah, no, no, yeah, yeah, man, and, just way too, I like the sounds, I like the shape some of these things make. Boy, would I love to get, no, forget it, that's the old days. But Michael Laskin will be here shortly. I want to mention a couple of things before he, before I give you his resume. Just a brief of his resume. A brief of, see, I stop myself because I want to speak well enough. I don't want to do those flubs and uhs and no, yeah, no, yeah, well, And I'm responsible for doing some of that stuff too. I was talking to my son tonight. And you know, when you start to tell someone something and you say, hey, you know what I did today? It's like you had a question or something. Hey, here's something interesting. You know, let me be the judge of that if you're talking to me. You know, people do that. I don't do that a lot. No less do I stuttering, stammering, that odd stuff drives me nuts. The book, was I talking about the book? No, I was talking about the talking. I was talking about the talking and the speaking. Man, being that I am the godfather of internet radio. That doesn't do much. That doesn't mean much. See, when you make a mistake, just correct it. And don't bring it to anyone's attention like I just did. But I'm doing that because I want you to speak well too. I do want that very much. I'm reminding you that back on when I said, you know, we're here live on SRN. And if you're listening and it's not Thursday night, between 9 and 11 p.m. Eastern time, then you're not. You're listening on one of the other great stations that carry us, and there are great stations. If you are listening, then you will hear, might hear, no, you're listening live, you will hear Savino Veritas, which will follow this program, but you won't hear it on other stations, all of them. See, you won't hear it on all other stations that I am on after my show. You might hear it separately, or you might hear it some other time, or you might not hear it. But you have to listen to it because it's great. And if you get to listen to it not on a station, you can always download it or go and listen straight off of juicedtalk.com. That's where my shows are also available for download and all the wonderful things you like to do with them. I don't know what that means. But with phones, phones aren't like iPods. When iPods came out, you had to, I don't think you could erase things. This is how much I know. I mean, I've been through this and I've been going, doing what I do here in the internet. In the internet? On the internet? Through the internet? You know, I don't know how that works. I'm on the internet. You're in the internet? Well, I'm in it, but I'm on it and I go through it and over it. I'm over the internet. Looks like you're over the air. Well, what was my point? My point was, the Montreal Jewish News is back, my friends, and you are my friends, and you are my friends are back. Maybe I'll do some imitations for him. I do horrible imitations. Although only recently I realized what a great imitation of Gilbert Gottfried I do. And you may be graced with it someday. Not today, not tonight, not tomorrow. And the MontrealJewishNews.com is back. It's gone for a while. A very popular column over there, as weekly as we can get it done, called Political Pulp. And you'll okay, pop your piece. It's called Political Pulp. Political Pulp. See, the easy way to do it, even if you have a windscreen, is to do it sideways. Don't talk right into the mic. Listen, if I talk into the mic politically, so you get a pop. If I talk away, I go Political Pulp. No, you don't get it. Go get the pop. You don't want to hear the pop. Neither. You don't want to hear it. So Political Pulp is back on Montreal Jewish News. There's a lot of serious news on there too, and things you want to know, a whole different angle of some news, and all of it's real. None of this crap. Everybody's talking fake news after I brought it up. Hello. So there's that. Go there weekly, read what's going on around there. And then of course that's connected to True Talk Radio. And we're on there too, twice a day. On weekdays. You can't miss this. So if you miss a Cotolo Chronicle somewhere and you don't feel like downloading it or whatever, or listening or whatever, just go over there during the day and the evening. I think it's noon, 10 to noon and something to something. Go over to TrueTalkRadio.com and Montreal Jewish News. Now also, it continues my regular blog, 148.ca/Frank. That is not an editorial by other people or by the people who run and operate 148.ca /Frank. I don't know what else. It's a backslash. But it's a slash. I've been trying to find out how, and maybe we'll get somebody who knows this one day to be on the show, how these things got their names. Last week, of course, we did that Word of the Year show, which was funny. Then we had to talk about net neutrality, which is not funny. Not funny. But once in a while we get serious about things. We just don't have an agenda. By the way, I'm going to have some weird people on. And the graphicscape just went pop, pop, pop. See, I go pop, 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 all I want on the side. Pop, 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 pop. Let me tell you that I have acted in the past, and one of the great ideas I had of all time, I think, because the best idea, you're only as good as your last idea, not last idea, I mean, as your most recent. You know, when you say last, it means last, and you know you're going to do it again, but you don't know if you're going to do it again. Life is a little too tenuous for that. But I've done some acting, as you all know, I think you know somehow. I think if you've listened, if not, you go to places to find out, or you Googled me or what have you. And I'm a terrible actor. I've done some stage work too, but always comedic and playing myself. This is why, and I don't mean I play myself, Frank Cotolo. I mean, I don't do a lot of acting. I say my lines, they believe the lines. I think it was Anthony Hopkins who said, acting is nothing. You go in, you read your lines. You know, you learn your lines, you go in and read your lines, you go home. Yeah, well, it's not that simple. And there are many, many classes and many books and things that you have to do to learn to be a good actor, and then the rest is luck. But that's not my point. My point is I never felt I did anything truly, even when I did a couple of serious parts. In other words, I was in a scene and a talking scene, and I didn't You know, I wasn't a certain character. I've done a character or characters and caricatures, but I've never done, like, you know, anything like, he was the brother of a drunken, or he was a drunken brother of a war soldier. And, you know, and then I'd have to be, because, you know, because I have a problem with the serious nature of that. I also have a problem. It's taken me years to write something serious, and I've been doing it. By the way, that reminds me, Amazon.com. I want to, there's a website called Goodreads. That's one word, Goodreads. I knew a guy named Goodstone. That was his name, Goodstone. Goodreads. And on Goodreads, people review books, buy books, want to read books, and they share ideas with books and people with everything. And on that, one of the poetry book I have out called Wordsworth Shelley, he's getting a couple of good reviews, and somebody sent something over there, and it's on Amazon, and it's a digital book. It's an e-book. So that's kind of serious. I mean, I've done some serious stuff, but I don't count poetry. Say, I'm talking about serious work, serious talking that people can do if they do acting, or, you know, serious. They're like, no jokes. And then I've done dramedy, which is I shouldn't say that. I hate that people have decided to use that word, comedy, drama. That's, you know, oh, I see. I got to tell him this. Oh. Let me tell Michael here. Oh, Skype. It's Skype. Skype. Okay. But just audio though. Okay. I had a little problem there. That's a personal thing, personal technical thing that just went on there. And you got to hear it because, you know, there's no editing. And there's no, this is just Cotolo Chronicles. My name is Frank Cotolo, man's name, the title of the show. Yes, Michael's right. We're going to get to Michael in a second. The books are, so there's Goodreads. And I guess now what's going to happen is people are going to start looking at the other books I have up there, and they're going to go over and start reading that stuff, or, you know, whatever, and buy books. You can buy books too. And they're good. So my series books are good. I say that because there's one series book that hasn't even come out yet, and I'm not telling you about it until I splash over, until you see me on the Dick Cavett show. And by the way, Dick Cavett doesn't even have a show anymore. So there's so much for that. Where else can I be? Who knows? I want to know that Charlie Rose thing, you know, cause it's so laid back. You just want to. The books are at blurb.com, amazon.com, lulu.com. And Michael's book is everywhere. Just, you know, look, just go The Authentic Actor or Authentic Actor. It's going to pop up on your various web search engine. But let me tell you a little about Michael before I just put him on the line here. Okay. You might have seen him in a couple of movies. And there are good movies, except one I don't understand, but you know, you gotta work. He's in, probably the most known movie, 1990, this going back. He was younger, a lot younger, so was I. He's a little younger than me by a year. That is a little. He's in The Grifters. This is a really good movie with, Angela, the one who invented stealing. That's not her right now. Angela Houston. I almost forgot her name. Houston. That's Houston's. Her father was Houston. Walter Houston. He was in the Grifters. He was in Disclosure in 1994. He was in Just Go With It, which is a recent movie with Adam Sandler and Barrymore. I haven't seen that because as you probably know how I feel about Adam Sandler, but I mean, would I work if they paid me a check? Yeah. When they pay me a check, or they pay me money, give me cash. I don't even need a check. Put the cash in a bag underneath the tree somewhere. Just tell me where the tree. He was in a Sensitivity Training, Chicanery, which was, the first movie done on an iPad or a Microsoft or a Windows or a Apple tablet. That was Charles Dennis's thing. But listen to this. Aside from TV movies, listen to this list of TV shows. You'll know a lot of these. This goes way back too. Melrose Place, NYPD Blue, LA Law, Doogie Howser. Now that's how long, because that guy's grown up already and he gets slashed and he bleeds all over the bed in Gone Girl. Whatever his name, Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry. You know, he was in Matlock, Falcon Crest, 21 Jump Street, not the movie, the original series, Moonlighting. Now, that really goes back. That's Bruce Willis's first TV show with the lady with the blonde hair, whose name I forgot. Knots Landing, not to be confused with the radio comedy Nuts Landing done with me and Wolfman Jack. That was written by me, but that was radio. Okay, Highway to Heaven, Hill Street Blues, Trapper John M.D., St. Elsewhere, Dallas, Simon & Simon, Heart to Heart in the 80s. That's the 80s. Man, this is a resume. I can't put a resume this long. This guy needs 2 pages. I'm going to get him on the phone. We're going to get started right here. My name is Frank Attola, a man whose name adorns the title of the show. And Michael Laskin, who will talk to us for the rest of the show. This is going to be great, too, because he's going to tell me things. And we'll talk about his book. And here goes the phone call. Here goes the phone call. Michael! What? We're calling Michael. Michael Laskin, hello? Call Skype. Why doesn't this work? Michael? Okay, Michael. Okay. I'm calling Skype. Hold on a second here. Okay. Calling Skype, but not connecting. What happened? What happened here? Let's find out. There's always something, you know? Calling Skype. Here goes Michael Laskin. Oh, I got it. Here it goes. I got it. It's ringing now. I got it.
Hey.
Hey. Hey. Mr. Laskin?
Yes, sir.
It was a short problem. I didn't mean to confuse you there. Skype is always doing something and they don't tell you how to do it, you know?
Skype is not what it's cracked up to be. Let's put it that way.
And believe me, they're cracking.
They're cracking, buddy.
Thing, you know, as it is. But it's okay. I can see I have your wonderful picture in front of me anyway. So, and okay. And this is radio. So it doesn't matter. I was just telling everyone, aside from the book, because we'll get to that in a second, that here's what I didn't tell them. Michael Laskin. Now, let's do a quiz. You know, please don't call up and don't go to whatever. Michael Laskin was born in the same city as these two pop artists, Bob Dylan and Bobby V. Everybody's, you know what they do? They cheat. You can't have contests anymore on the radio, Michael.
No, everybody cheats.
Yeah. They go to their phone. They go to the thing. They look it up and they think things.
Cheaters, Frank. It's what's happening.
It is. It's horrible.
Not only was I born in the same city as, I never knew Bobby V, but Bob Dylan's mother and my mother were very close friends. His mother was at my wedding.
So, because she knew your mother?
Yeah, they were family friends.
Mrs. Zimmerman, right?
Exactly. Beatty Zimmerman and then later on Beatty Rutman when she remarried. But I never knew him because he's that much older than I am. I mean, I'm old as hell, but he's old as dirt. He's probably, I don't know how
old Bob Dylan is.
But yeah, we're all from the Paris of the North, Duluth, Minnesota. See, I ruined it for your crowd here.
That's all right. They're not here to do geography. Bob Dylan is older, but you're only a year younger than I am.
Possibly. I don't know how old you are.
I know, like you were gonna say, like you did research, right? What is it? What's the difference? No.
Yes. The other famous person from Duluth, Minnesota, is Lorenzo Music.
Really?
Yeah. Yep.
I thought that was a publishing company.
Yeah, no. Lorenzo Music's his original name was Jerry Music. That's for real. He said he changed his name from Jerry Music to Lorenzo Music. You know, he created Rhoda and he was Garfield the Cat and all that stuff. He was a pretty well-known writer, director, and animation performer.
You don't meet many Lorenzos, do you?
You do not.
Who is Lorenzo Sample? Always comes to mind. Semple or Sample? What was it?
I'm going with Semple.
Yeah. What did he do?
No idea.
Okay. And he was a producer or something. And he was involved in that. I was telling everyone, I just ran through some of these TV credits, which even when you were on before, I didn't realize you had been on so many of these shows. Now, a lot of the people who listen to this show don't even know these shows because they're younger.
Right.
But one thing stopped me. I got to have to ask you about this. One thing. The TV movie A Death in California.
Yes.
Okay. I believe that, if I'm not mistaken, I don't know how many movies there were related to that. Is this the story about the family that's held hostage in a house that people come and rip, right? Is that that one?
Man, you're asking me something. That's a credit from the 80s.
Yeah.
I think
it is that. I knew the family.
I think that sounds about right.
I think there's only one there.
The only thing I remember, the star was, I'm blanking on her name. She was quite a good actress and a really nice, nice woman. But the director was a guy named Delbert Mann, mm-hmm. who directed the original Marty and the movie, the TV production of Marty with, yeah, Delbert Mann. He was a really old timer then. It was one of the last things he did. And he was a great director. I mean, you just knew you were in the presence of somebody who was very, very good. Yeah, Delbert Mann.
I tell all my listeners, even older ones too, you know, keep a notebook and write down things so that later on you could research this stuff, because we can't stop in the middle of the show and just explain to anyone. The movie is Marty, and I don't know, do you know anywhere that the TV, because it was a TV show first on there on the Electric Drama Theater Live there, whatever.
I think it was a live, one of those live TV dramas they did out of New York.
You don't know where to find that though.
Anyway. Oh, that, you know, YouTube probably has it. I mean, you know, the movie Requiem for a Heavyweight was also done as a live TV play.
Yeah.
With Jack Palance in the Anthony Quinn role. So
Rod Serling. Rod Serling wrote that, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
But Marty, of course, you know, was a movie of the year, and Ernest Borgnine won it. And
he won the Academy Award for that.
Steiger got nothing. Didn't even get an Emmy, did he, for TV?
I don't know. He did okay.
That's Chayefsky, right? That's Chayefsky.
I think so, but
Patty Chayefsky, right?
I'm not going to be Googling the stuff. I'll take your word. I'm going to take your word for everything, Frank.
Well, yeah, I want to take your word for stuff because I don't know. And this is what else I was telling. Anyway, we know how impressive this is. And what did you do in the movie Just Go With It? Where were you in that?
That's an interesting, interesting story. I was going to say, if you have time.
We have plenty of time, yeah.
I'll tell you the whole story. So at that point, 2011, whenever that movie came out or whenever it was, I get a call from my manager, said they want to see you for this part. It's Adam Sandler's father in the movie Just Go With It. And he said, it's going to work one day. And I said, I don't think I even want to go. If it's going to work one day, I don't want to go in on it. He said, go in on it, because on these Adam Sandler movies, they're always changing the script. They're always throwing stuff out. And people, you know, they'll book you for one day. You'll be on it for 3 weeks and you'll make a lot of money. And so I said, okay, I'll go in on it. So I go in and I meet this casting director. Adam wasn't there yet. Just meet him, like, literally, there's almost nothing in the script at all. And didn't think twice, just, you know. Went back about my life. Get a call from them. They really want you. Adam really wants you. Like, okay. Well, I didn't meet Adam, but I guess he saw some video of me or whatever. And, but they don't want to, they were paying like nothing, like really bad. You know, I said, well, I'm not going to do it for that amount of money. So literally, they were offering like $750 a day, which sounds like a lot of money, but for an actor at a certain stature, that's really low. And, you know, you might only work one day in 6 months. So you can't make a living doing that. So I said, you know what? I'm going to pass. I don't think I'm not interested in that. It just doesn't, no. Long and short of it, no. So he said, well, if you pass, just be aware that it'll go somewhere else. It'll go to somebody else. I said, that's fine. So they come back to me and they really want you. I said, well, then negotiate something and make them pay. They have money. Yeah, I mean, it's not like this is a, you know, a low budget art film. This is a really broad, you know, commercial kind of film. Mm-hmm. So long story short, they negotiated a very good deal. And I'm thinking, what in the world? I just had no idea how this was going to go. So I get invited to a reading of the screenplay over at the Sony lot. And there were some, you know, Nicole Kidman is in that movie and some very good people. Mm. And I walk in and I literally bump into Adam Sandler. I haven't met him yet. I literally like go around the corner and we practically knock each other over. And he goes, Pops. And so he told me later, he said, you reminded me of my uncle, I don't know, Uncle Sid or yeah. Uncle Morty or something. He said, I just had to have you. So the one line turned into, I think I worked 12 or 13 days. So it ended up being a pretty good payday. And he was great. I have to say he was great. And what my manager told me was absolutely true. They literally throw out everything. Okay, Adam will say, okay, here's what we're going to do. Pops, you come in this door and you do this and you're going to say this. And he literally like off by the seat of his pants throws something at you that you have to be pretty quick to, it's not easy. Mm-hmm. Everybody struggles with it because he's got a lot of ideas and he's spitting them out really fast and he'll throw an entire scene off the top of his head at three people and say, okay, you got it. And you go, no, actually. Not really. But anyway, I did it. It was fun. It was a good experience. Totally cut out of the movie.
Really?
Yeah, 100%. There's one scene where my face is in the background. And because there was an entire storyline with Adam's mom and his dad and his sister. And we all were made up to kind of look like him. And they just cut the storyline out. So they kept us in to the extent that I still get nice residuals on that movie. But, sure. You know, it's one of those weird Hollywood experiences where, I don't even want to go in for it. They really want you. Well, they're not going to pay any money. Well, okay, they're going to pay some money. And one line turned into 13 days of filming. And after all that, you're cut out of the movie.
Well, you know, but, I don't watch any more Adam Sandler movies. And the other thing I was going to say is
that speaks well of you.
I've never been, you know, an Adam Sandler fan. It escaped me. You know?
Me either.
And then of course, like a lot of other comedians who soar up the ladder there, he tried some serious stuff. And what I was going to tell you in the beginning when I said, my goodness, you were in this movie. He sure could use you because he might be a great guy and everything like that. But, I don't know much about acting. I don't want to ask a lot about it to you, but man, is he bad?
Well, I've seen him in a couple things where I thought he was pretty good, but in general, I don't. Though. You know, I don't know. I had on a personal level, I had a really great experience with him. His company treats people really well.
That's good.
You're very well taken care of. It's a very nice, supportive place to work. But yeah, I mean, the movie is just kind of a dopey movie.
Told my friends who really, younger friends who really like him, and I said, I got only one thing to say about Adam Sandler, and that is that he, is among a generation that had a lot of good comics, you know? And
oh, yes.
When he hit the big time for one reason or another, and let's face it, I think he's a phenomena. That just happened, right? With him and his audience caught on with those dumb movies. The point I'm trying to make here is though, he continually gives his friends, all those guys, work. You know?
Yeah.
That's a wonderful thing, I think. I said, that guy, he's okay. And he does, and he's produced a lot of movies that those guys would never have been in. Because he has the money and stuff. So.
A couple of movies that I thought, I don't know if you saw the movie Funny People.
I did see, I could not sit through that movie.
I thought that was an interesting attempt. And he did a very serious movie called Rain Over Me with Don Cheadle, which.
Oh, that's the one about the 9/11 people? He was doing
Yeah. And then he did another movie a number of years ago with Paul Thomas Anderson, who did There Will Be Blood,
In There Will Be Blood?
No, but he did. Paul Thomas Anderson did a movie.
I was going to say.
He was not.
How did I miss that?
you definitely missed that. Now, Paul Thomas Anderson did a movie called Punch Drunk Love.
That was
interesting. And it's a serious movie. And Adam's in that. And he's pretty good in that. But yeah, you know, he's an acquired taste. Yeah,
but anyway, we're not here to talk about Adam. But I did want to know that. And that's a good. And I imagine even though he's in some tough, a lot of people in some tough times, even people with, who are, you know, got a lot of worth and value, right?
There's and you know, the thing about, somebody was telling me, this lawyer that I know, who had done some legal work for, this is for his company, had said, you know, all those movies you think are terrible that are big flops, he said, they all make money.
Right.
They all make money, so he knows exactly what he's doing. So if we think, you know, sometimes even my wife will see an actor and we'll say, God, I haven't seen him or her in anything for a while. I said, they're working. You just don't see them. You know, the stuff they're working in is maybe isn't as high profile, but yeah, the business is in my career span changed just exponentially. And part of that is just getting older as well. And you're kind of, you get a little bit aged out of it unless you're a celebrity of sorts. And,
right. Cause you're always your role is always changing what's available for you.
Yeah. There isn't a lot available right now for an actor, of my type and my age, unless you're a celebrity. That stuff kind of goes to celebrities, and I'm not that. I'm a celebrity in Studio City where I live, by the way. But in the world at large, not so much.
Michael Laskin is with us. Well, I think, isn't there a lot of work, though, now with small screen stuff, Netflix?
I think there's more work now, and I think there's an enormous amount of work now. Mm. It's happening not just here in Los Angeles, but all over the world. I mean, I just helped an actress today create an audition for a project. She lives here, but the project is going to film in New York. Stuff films in Atlanta and New Orleans and in Europe. It's decentralized a little bit. Not only the production business, but the talent business. I mean, there are people who are actors and actresses in places like Atlanta and New Orleans mm-hmm. who have been able to create somewhat of a career for themselves. It's not all, look, most of the opportunities for actors in film and television are still, of course, in New York and Los Angeles.
Right.
But, you know, it's the one thing that's constant in this whole thing is change. It is always changing. And, I know in California, we had a really big problem with runaway production, you know, things not filming here because it was too expensive to film here. And then a couple of years ago, the state legislature enacted a really strong tax incentive program. And now they're filming a lot of stuff here again, which is great. So there you are.
And then of course there's all the stand-up comedians, all the people out there looking to get different work. You know, I don't know. It's funny too, because, you know, a lot of stand-up comedians, well, you know, they wind up, well, look at Sandler. I mean, he started off as a stand-up comedian. And recently, a friend of mine who's a stand-up comedian runs into him because he's going back, you know, and he goes there to do some new material and stuff like that. He doesn't let go. But, you know, you could sense and you could see it in their eyes. They had a picture. You see it in their eyes how disappointed they are to a certain extent. You could be making all the money in the world. But, you know, they're young and they've gone through this entire other life. And they're, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I think, you know, the stand-up comedian as a type of entertainment has been so central for so long, and it has been a conduit for people who become actors.
Yeah. I mean,
the biggest example is Jerry Seinfeld. And I think it's changed a lot. I mean, a lot of these guys, a lot of the stand-ups are doing, like Zach Galifianakis is doing this really amazing show that I haven't seen yet called Baskets on FX.
Yeah, I knew Louis, you know, Louis Anderson won a...
I
knew him when he first came to town. I was living in Los Angeles when he first came to town. And he's just doing, you know, fat jokes, stand-up fat jokes. And then he disappeared for a while.
Yeah, he went to high school with my wife in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Hey, you're right. He's from Minnesota too, and even another Minnesotan comes up.
Look what Louis C.K. has done with his show. And, you know, that's it. So I think the exciting thing for actors today is that, as you said, Frank, there's a lot more outlets for the work. And I think the thing that's changed so much is, and I encourage you, because I teach, as you know, I think I encourage people to become part of the creative supply chain yourself. Create content for yourself, whether you're a comedian or an actor. There's nothing to stop you from doing that anymore. It used to be in the old days.
Yeah, back then.
When I was a youngster. But you were an actor, you developed a reputation, you got an agent, and you waited for the phone call, and then you had auditions. Now it's not, I mean, that still goes on, but I think, you know, I know a lot of young actors and actresses who have created content and created web series, and not all of them are good, but there's nothing to stop you from doing it. If you have an idea and an iPhone 6, you can make a freaking movie.
So, sure. You were in one.
Yes, I was.
You were in Charles's, wasn't Chicanery done?
iPad movie, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one I was telling everyone. Yeah, I was telling everyone the last time you were on, the most recent time you were on was with Charles Dennis for that, we're talking about that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's right, because it's just like, there's more, the technology moved into the area of a visual after it conquered audio. After it destroyed the record business, it got better. And then it went into audio too, and you're right, because there are people, I mean, there's people doing shows all the time, every Tom, Dick, and Harry.
There's all kinds of, like, this is an extreme example, and I think this has gone away, but there was a thing called Vine. Do you know Vine?
Oh, Vine, yeah. Yes, a friend of mine made me do a bunch of Vines with him. Yeah, that
was. I knew a guy, a friend of mine, who was a first-time feature film director, who had a million and a half dollar film greenlit based on two people who had high Vine viewership. Now,
Vine's gone.
Vine's gone. But I mean, that is an extreme example of basically they're looking for eyeballs. They're looking for people who have high numbers of hits on YouTube, on Vine, on Instagram and Twitter and all that. That's kind of the new currency. It has nothing to do with whether the artist is of any quality at all. In fact, it's usually it's usually converse, you know. But that is part of the landscape, and will be. It seems like now that we have a Twitter president, will be for a long time.
Well, this brings up element. This brings up the book and stuff I want to talk to you about that has to do with the book and the series acting, because, you know, the stuff we're talking about, you know, third and fourth grade, I'm grading actors. I don't even, how do you grade them? I don't know. You know, used to do A movies and B movies.
Sure.
Let's do letter grading. D actors, you know, can wind up in so many things. You can get what, can get work. And although that was always the case, you know, there were always needed to be background and character people and stuff like that. I want to talk to you about the book, your book, for two, in terms of what you say in the title, which confused me. I think it's a concept that confuses me. Business, we understand. It's a business. It's a profession. It's what you do. Of being yourself. Now, this is why this strikes me. Because the acting that I've done, few parts, little parts, and through the years in movies and this and the other thing, or writing, and then, you know, some TV and stuff. But, I and some stage, but I never felt like I acted. I always felt like the problem with me is that, you know, I can't play a guy. You know, you're going to be the drunken brother of the war hero. And I'm like, well, how do I do a drunken brother? You know, even if I look at the words, I wind up doing myself. I'm terrible. Michael, I'm terrible. And, and the book. Well, so I want you to explain that and then even give me a few lessons that are from that are in the book, so that we could also get people out there to realize that that you should take this seriously as a foundation, right? And you could do crazy stuff and everything later, but isn't it important to get
100%. I mean, I do. I'll tell you, I come from a very traditional theater background. I worked off Broadway. I worked at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, which was a very prestigious place to work, and many, many other places like that, including London and all over the country, Seattle and Los Angeles and stuff.
A lot of stage, right?
Pardon me?
A lot of stage work. A
lot of stage for, you know, almost continuously for close to 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you get really, really good at that. You get good at that. And the whole notion of acting on the stage and theater training, it trains you to become somebody else other than yourself. That's kind of the, if you will, the rewardable virtue is that, oh, they come backstage and they say, I didn't even recognize you.
Yeah.
I just, the character, you disappeared. Yeah. Well, that's cool. And that's what that is. And I did all that and I was really good at that. And then I came to California, had an opportunity to come out here. I had done a play that was very successful out here. My wife and I decided to move here. This is 32, 33 years ago. And I started doing film and television right away. I got lucky. I got a very good agent right away and I started working right away. And I was completely lost because the theater training is almost antithetical to what film acting is. And it took me a very long time to make that pivot. And the pivot is this. Theater is about what you can do and film and television is essentially about who you are. So that's like I always tell classes when I start. I say, you know, when you have a really good book and you skip to the end because you want to see how it ends. So that's the end of the book. Mm. That's the takeaway. Because a perfect example of someone like that is an actor like Seth Rogen, mm-hmm. who I think is great. I love him. I think he's very funny. But he's not going to play Hamlet at the New York Shakespeare Festival.
Right.
You know, he just is extremely good at being who he is. And he's done enough work now that he's quite skilled. He wasn't that skilled when he started, but he has. It's just like, you know, if you came to my house, and you knocked on my door and I met you for the first time, you would have an instant blink of an eye feeling about me and I about you.
Hmm.
That's a little bit what film is like. You walk into a scene on film. The audience hasn't met you before and they instantly go, oh, he's interesting or she's sad or you have a blink of an eye. That's not, as I say in the book, it's not show business. That's human business. That's how we react. And that's kind of what film really,
what was that?
That's kind of a film. That's the currency in film is to be, that's what makes stars.
Right.
You know, Jimmy Stewart was always Jimmy Stewart. He was within that range. He was very versatile, but there was an essential core quality about him and all the great stars,
right.
Not only more of them of olden days than today, because there's not as many great stars today, but they embody something central. And so they are authentic and they are being themselves. But that doesn't mean you don't have skills. You take those skills that you acquire in theater training. You know, theater training is great for the fact that you can – it makes actors generally very, very good with the text. You understand the text. You understand how to approach the text. You understand where the opportunities to make your point in any particular scene might be. It also helps you with voice, use of voice and movement and things like that. But other than that, I mean, I know a lot of people who are not trained at all, who are fantastic on film. And I know people who just can't make the transition. So the reason I wrote the book to get, it's kind of your original premise and question.
Right.
Is that I saw that all these places where they train actors are still using old ideas that are, you know, they're still teaching, Meisner and Lee Strasberg and those are all great ideas. They're all also 75 or 80 years old and they're not as, frankly, as they don't hold as much sway anymore. So I thought if I'm going to do this, it was actually Jeff Tambor who wrote the, was a great actor and a good friend of mine who wrote the foreword to my book who encouraged me. And I said, I want to just pretend that I am a space alien who has come to Earth, and I've never seen an actor, I've never seen an acting class, never seen a movie, never seen a play. What is this thing that they're doing where they pretend to be somebody else? I wanted to just look at it fresh. That's a really hard thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I just started to write my thoughts down. I started writing blogs, and I published a lot of blogs, and some of which are very good. And they kind of became the basis of the book. But it took me a few years to really let me put it to you this way. I didn't want to do this unless I had something original and interesting to contribute. There's a lot of teachers. Most of them are, frankly, awful. Mm-hmm. For many reasons. They either teach one method that's way out of date, or they're gurus and need to be worshipped, or they never actually worked themselves, so they defaulted to teaching.
Actors with egos? Come on.
Yeah. So if you eliminate all those people, you've eliminated 75 or 80% of the people who call themselves teachers. So I take it quite seriously, and I have found that what I do has brought forward a rather inordinate amount of success in my students and clients, because I think my approach is different and fresh. And it doesn't mean you can't be a highly trained, highly skilled actor, but you have to understand who you are. You have to understand who you are. And the dilemma is in the film and television world today, most of the opportunities are for 19-year-olds who, by definition, have no idea who they are.
So you're saying in a personal sense, you have to know who are you, who's your character, right?
Well, I think so. I do this thing. I just met with a guy this week who's going to be joining my class, and I said, this is what I do. This is what I want you to do the first week in class. And this is a very good actor, and he's got very good representation. He's worked a bit. He's not like a schlepper, you know.
Okay, is this something you would tell somebody like a schlep like me?
I would tell anybody.
Okay, good. Let's hear it.
Including a schlepper like you, Frank.
Go, tell me.
I said, when you come to class the first time, I want you to bring in two things. One, bring in something you're really good at. It's probably a speech from a play or a monologue or something you do. Bring in something that every good actor, if you don't have a couple of those things in your back pocket, I just killed when I did that. I'm going to do that speech. Mm. Bring in something you think you're really good at that shows me what you think the full effect of your talent is. And every good actor has something like that. Okay, so that's assignment number one. Assignment number two is I have an exercise I want you to do. You have to write. And a lot of actors freak out when you ask them to write because I'm not an actor. I'm not a writer. I'm an actor. I said, I want you to write something, and the title of this something is called This Is What I Know. I want to know what you know. I said, you don't have to memorize it. There's no set length. And literally start off with what's around you. Like, I know that I have to have one Splenda in my coffee in the morning. It just works for me. I know that traffic sucks. I know just the stuff that's literally affecting your life every day. And just keep writing it until eventually it ladders up into bigger things. And you start saying, you start talking about parents, about siblings, about expectations, about disappointments, about love, about guilt. I said, and just start every sentence with, this is what I know. And I don't need to know your deepest, darkest secrets. This isn't therapy by any means.
But they're writing this now, right? They're writing. They're not saying it.
No, they're writing it, and then they're going to recite it in class. They're going to speak it in class. So I say, if I see what you can do with that wonderful piece that you bring in that you think you're great at, and you probably are, and then if I see your point of view, your worldview, this is what I know, this is how I see the world, when I put those two things together, I have the full picture of the actor. And the this is what I know, the worldview, the point of view, always in film and television dominates. It's like, how else do you explain certain actors who have, they just have a force of personality. They just can dominate by just being there. They have, I go back to Seth Rogen or people like that. They just occupy the screen in a way that you know exactly who they are the minute they come forward.
Well, but from what you're saying here then, let me just interrupt for a second. What you're saying here, as I'm absorbing this, is that what I do here, especially when I don't have guests and have a conversation, but when I sit here and do 2 hours of talking about this, that, and the other thing, I don't write it down. I just do it. And that's me. I mean, I would feel stupid writing that stuff down because I could just do it. I don't know what that's called, because I don't, what is that when you can do stuff like that? Because the worst time I've ever had with acting is, number one, remembering lines. I'm terrible, but there's obviously a million tricks you could do for that. And the second thing is being self-conscious.
Yeah. And you know what? That's every, if you have a brain in your head, and I don't accept the cliche that actors are, you know, a lot of people think, oh, they're just stupid. Actually, the best actors I know are very smart. Mm-hmm. You have a brain in your head. You do have these conversations about, you know, you get in your own way and you create a headspace that's not healthy for you. You know, you have to just, basically, you are the actor is the vessel through which the material flows. And on film and television in particular, it's just a more truthful, dynamic version of who you already are. So you have to know who you are. You know, in theater, you can hide. You can pretend to be somebody you're not. I go to these, I teach in the spring at UCLA. I teach the MFA students. And they're all in what I call the black leotard phase of their acting career. You know, and that's great. I mean, I did that. I know what that's like. But they, and you know, if somebody tells you, well, I just do this. I spent 6 months in Ireland. I do a flawless Irish accent. And you want to say, well, they'll get an Irishman. Why would they hire you? They'll get somebody who is that person. Uh-huh. Well, you know, that's what it is. They don't need you to be somebody else. They need you to actually be who you are.
I guess, well, in the old days, you know, I was talking on this show a couple of months ago about The Good Earth, the Paul Muni, the original version.
Yeah.
Again, there is no other version. I don't know why they never remade that. And because I was telling everyone, because I like to pass on some of these things to younger people who haven't go watch this stuff, that it's now it's strange to sit there and watch Paul Muni play the main character, who's Chinese, and Louise Rainer play the Chinese wife, and then these stock Oriental players who, you know, show up in Charlie Chan films and whatever else, they're the real Chinese people are in there, but the main characters are not Chinese.
Yeah. Crazy.
Today, there's a lot less of that today, isn't there?
There's none of that.
Okay.
But, no, they're like, Muni is a great example of a guy who was, I mean, certainly an incredible actor.
Yeah.
But he was what I would call a transformational actor. He was known for being wildly different from role to role. I mean, one movie he was a Chinese man. One movie he's Louis Pasteur.
Right.
You know, he was known for that. And I think that's like the other example that I've used that I think is really, and it's current because most people have seen it. Like if you saw Lincoln.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Daniel Day-Lewis is the furthest thing from Lincoln in real life. That's a transformational performance. He transforms himself into Lincoln. And it's amazing. That's a kind of acting that's more theater based, and it's, but he was brilliant in it.
But that's not Stanislavski stuff, right? Or is it? I mean, is he feeling, you know, living the part, right?
I don't quite know what his, I think he has a, from what I know, he has a process that's pretty much his own.
Oh, because they said he was, he's walking around as Lincoln.
Yeah, I think I think he gets into it, and he's a pretty singular talent. But in the same movie, you have Tommy Lee Jones playing Thaddeus Stevens.
Right.
And he's just playing it like it's a Tommy Lee Jones part. Nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
He was amazing in that part. But, you know, so the core qualities of Thaddeus Stevens tended to line up with Tommy Lee Jones, which is intelligence. He's intelligent. He's cantankerous. He's difficult. He, you know, Tommy Lee Jones has certain things about him that are there in almost everything he does.
And that's what gets him those particular parts, because they have, right? That's him.
Yeah, you have two amazing performances in the same movie, one transformational and one not, and both equally brilliant. There's room, you know, there's no one right way to do it, but I thought they were both astounding performances.
So back to, what you're talking about. So in the beginning, you come in, and you say, hello, Dr. Laskin. Professor Laskin, how about, I think, you know what else? Influence. I have too many of my influences in every possible way are humorous, in writing, in acting, and I don't know, could that have hurt me?
I can't see how it could.
Because if I even attempt to do a page of Shakespeare, on, you know, a monologue or anything like that, I'm given to just fly. I'm dig a rabbit hole and just keep going somewhere. It's difficult to stay where I am. The improv thing just got, and I was in an improv group for a while out, and some of those people actually went on to be good actors and everything. When I was in New York, and then they all went to California. But I just don't understand finding that space where, you know, like I said, you're the drunken war hero's brother. That's it. So don't go anywhere from there, you know, and stay with these lines.
Well, but look, you who I've only met through my computer box and a little bit on Facebook, you have a very distinct voice. You have a very distinct personality in just in how you present yourself. That's who you are. And that doesn't suit everything. I mean, with actors, there are actors who serve the material. Mm-hmm. There are actors who dominate the material by force of personality. And if you went further in acting, that's what you would be. You want to, you know, we need a Frank Cotolo guy. We need a guy. Well, let's get Frank. He's available.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get that. How would somebody, and I'm not doing this for me because I'm going to run out and be an actor, which, by the way, in Grantville, Pennsylvania is particularly difficult. but how does someone come to you and learning to be themselves and then nobody knows them? So how do they look for any kind of work? I mean, who am you going to be? You're just going to put yourself into whatever? Am I explaining myself, my difficulties correctly here?
I think what you're asking, if I can rephrase it, is the enormity of the task of trying to forge a career and a life and a presence as an actor is exactly that. It's an enormous task, and it takes a great deal of luck.
Yeah.
A great deal of luck. And persistence. If say, you know what, I'm in for the next 10 years, no matter what, I'm in. And it's just like anything else. The more you do it, the better you get. It's like the 10,000 hour rule. You know, you put the time in. There's no shortcut really to getting the skills and but as far as having a career and a life, you know, I know, a lot of exceedingly talented people who never had much of a career.
Right.
And I know people who are very modestly talented who've had big careers. And every gradation of that in between.
That's true in every profession, artistic or not.
But it's not – here's the other thing for your audience and for yourself. It's not like, hey, if you're a concert violinist, you can either play that concerto properly or you can't. There's an entry level thing there that unless you can do that, you're not even going to be considered a concert. There's a certain technical requirement. If you're a pianist or any kind of a, you know, fine musician, you can't just, it's acting isn't the same way really. It's a lot of people's opinions. Oh, I really like him. He's interesting. It's different if you're doing Shakespeare and stuff that's very, very challenging and the English system of training and all that is different, but there isn't an empirical truth. There isn't a technical bar you have to pass, really. Okay. You can just, you say, I'm an actor, you're an actor. Right. And then you either are or you aren't, and you have to live, that and decide. It's about commitment in a way. You know, you're either in or you're not in. And if you're in, you got to stay in, and you got to give it a, you know, and then no one will fault anyone for walking away from it, because it's tough. I mean, it's a really, it's a very tough,
But the personal satisfaction part, the part where you know you get to a point, I mean, of course, luck and all the stuff that makes it a career, fine, and making money doing it at all or what have you. But there comes a part, a time in anything, where you go, you know, I am now good enough. I can, you know, the rest is luck and how much work I put into it and how much exposure I give myself, but how much I, whatever. But I know I'm okay. Right. I know. Yeah. I'm right. Okay. That's when you know yourself, correct?
Well, once you answer the talent question, am I talented enough? Am I competitive with the top people? Can I actually go to a place like New York or LA and be competitive and get jobs?
Well, define talent in this situation, though. I mean, you know what I'm saying? With what point does talent, the mechanics and whatever you do, blend into, you know, talent, a consciousness of a person who can act.
I think that talent cannot be taught. You either have talent or you don't. I could give a scene, a two-page scene from a play or a movie to 100 different people, and say, take a look at this for 5 minutes and come back and read it for me. And only a small handful of them would come back with something really interesting. The rest of them wouldn't know what to do with it. And the ones who come back with something really interesting have a certain amount of innate talent. They can look at text and give it life. Mm-hmm. It's not something you can really teach at the most basic level. But what you can teach is strategy within that scene. Like, okay, if that scene is the character's aria from the opera, what's the high note? And why is that the high note? And how do you frame that? Where do you pause? And where does it change? That's all just basic acting strategy stuff that if you're a really good actor, you do that stuff instinctively. If you're not yet a good actor, you need guidance and you need someone to point out to you. I mean, my only value as a teacher is my point of view and my experience. Mm. I'm not a guru. I'm not going to be able to transform your life and give you that ecstatic moment in an acting class that, you know, I look at it like building a house. You got to lay the foundation. You got to put in the plumbing, and you know, it's not rocket science. It's just a craft. And once you get good enough at the craft, you stop seeing the craft, and that's where the art emerges. It's like watching Fred Astaire dance. I mean, it's effortless. It's like lighter than air, but he rehearsed and sweated his ass off for probably 20 years before he got to that point. You know, so you don't see his technique. You don't see the craft. You just see the artistry. And that's kind of what actors have to strive for. And not everybody gets there, you know. But when you have answered the talent question, like I did, I don't know if you know this, but I did a play of Charles Dennis's earlier in 2016. Are you aware of it? Did we talk about that?
I remember of it. This isn't the Nixon, is it? The Nixon?
No. That's another thing that's on Funny or Die that Charles and I put together called You Don't Know Dick.
Yeah.
Very funny.
There was another one. I remember seeing stuff on there.
But I did this play called Altman's Last Stand.
Oh, yeah. Of course, we talked about. Yes. Yeah, so that. Yes. The old guy who owned the What's It Shop. And yeah. Okay.
Right. And he's a 90-year-old Holocaust survivor. Mm-hmm. And it's a one-person play. And so an actor looking at that goes, oh my God. Like, first of all, it's an hour and 20 minutes of one person talking.
Right.
And you have to learn that, which is itself a gargantuan task. And then you have to play this character who's very different than you. So for me at this stage in my life and in my career, I took that on because I thought I'm never going to get a chance to do something this challenging. And I didn't do it because I thought somebody would see it and I'd get a big job out of it. I did it for altruistic reasons. I did it for artistry, and it was a great success. We did very well with it, and it was a wonderful production. But that was, you know, every once in a while you have to climb the mountain again, and that's what that was for me. And I think actors need that. You don't get that doing a 2-scene page on NCIS.
Right. We're with Michael Laskin here. I'm just take this short break here. It's me, Frank Atolo, here with Michael Laskin, and the actor, acting teacher, and the author of The Authentic Actor, not the ingenuous actor. Could there be an opposite book? Who do we get? Who is the person? We don't want to badmouth anyone. And he's trying to tell me things that would explain why I'm not a good actor or why I have not done any of that well enough. And the book is available. The digital book is available everywhere, and hardcover too, right?
They never did a hardcover. We did it. It's a softcover book. It's available on Amazon, of course, Barnes & Noble, and the publisher's website, MWP.com. You can get it through there as well.
NWP?
M as in Michael, W as in water, P as in Peter, MWP.com.
Michael Water Peter.
Yes, there you go.
Michael Water Peter is a website for, well, you heard it, folks. Go get it. I don't know, because I think of things like, you know, in a book like this, and then if I just to fool around, you know, because I think I'm stuck as a writer. And that's another thing I was going to tell you. Now, writers usually can't do the kind of acting that a great actor can do. And yet, like, see, if you're on stage doing a David Mamet play, and David Mamet is directing, you know, you always see, I would imagine, especially him, would go up and go, why are you saying it that way? Why don't you realize what's happening here? You know, and it's like, well, you know, you say it then and do your play. What? I can't, you know what I mean? How they can't act. People, a lot of directors are actors, so they know, but a lot of people, writers, tell actors how to act.
Yeah.
I don't really get that. Is that just that one area where it's like you don't know this piece enough, or what are they saying?
The best directors I've encountered, with almost no exceptions, have been actors,
right?
Because they understand what it is that we have to do. Mamet is an interesting example because he writes in an extremely specific way. Mm-hmm. No one else writes like David Mamet. And I've had people do, and it sounds just like the way normal people talk, but it isn't. Mm-hmm. It's actually really, it's very precise. If you change one little bit in some of those lines, they don't work. Even though it sounds very casual and very conversational, it's extremely well crafted, I've never worked with him, but he apparently is exactly what you said, a director who has very strong opinions on acting, and you know, they'll quarrel with success. He's a very successful guy. I think he's a wonderful writer. The stuff that he's directed that I've seen, he's directed a couple of films that were just awful. Awful. He's not a good director, but
what didn't you like? State and Maine? Tell me the ones you didn't like. Come on.
Didn't like State and Maine.
Okay.
I mean, the script was good. Mm-hmm. Didn't like, was it House of
Cards? Oh, House of Cards? You didn't like House of Cards.
I liked the script. I just thought it was badly directed. He's not really a natural director.
Mm-hmm. And more, what would be, so you can watch this and you go, I like the script. And you liked how the actors displayed this, you know, presented the script, or did his directing ruin it? I mean, what, give me a professional.
I don't know how to say this without sounding arrogant, but I'm sophisticated enough as an artist and as a viewer that I can look at something and go, you know, that's a terrific script. And I can see how it could be better.
Okay.
It does function and work, but Mamet in particular has a way of directing actors to do everything extremely flat And I just don't think it works. When it works, it's great, but a lot of times it doesn't work.
Spanish Prisoner? Did you see the Spanish Prisoner?
I did not see that.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I did not see it. And I mean, Glengarry is a phenomenal, I didn't like the movie as well as I liked the play, but it's a phenomenal piece of writing.
You're right, because I saw the play when I was in Los Angeles. I saw it with the Columbo. I forgot his name. I'm terrible.
I did too, and he was great. Yeah.
Columbo. It's not who I'm talking. You know who I'm talking about.
Peter Falk.
Yeah, Peter Falk and some other.
Tanya.
Yes, of course. Yeah, okay. He was, yeah.
Yeah, it was great.
So maybe it has something to do with play. Well, then he's an anomaly in that respect too. It's not like a movie director can tell someone how to act because there's so many other elements involved. But when I was just talking about saying a line, saying lines, and right now if I read you some lines, you'd probably go, I'll be on someone else's show next time I'm talking about acting.
you're so hard on yourself.
I am, but I, you know, because
a smart director would see a guy like you and go, okay, this is the right part for this guy. He's not going to play this guy. He's not right for that guy, but he can totally play this guy. And a smart writer would hear you speak and say, I can write something for him. I understand how he expresses himself. So, you know.
So that just makes it easier for the actor.
Of course.
Oh, I like that.
absolutely. You should, you know, you're very specific as far as how you sound and how you phrase things. And so, yeah, you know, when I meet people who are that specific in my coaching and stuff, I always say, don't change, don't make them change you. Don't let them change you. You're absolutely, you are. Make what you do fit the material.
Could I do the fool in King Lear?
Sure.
Oh, good. Oh, really?
Sure.
Okay.
It would be a different way to do it, but yeah.
But it would, okay, that kind of thing. Cause you just, I always bring up Shakespeare cause, you know, I just love that, you know, what he does in X amount of time on paper and in a story and, you know, how he it just, you know, it's a landmark, of, you know, you want to learn how to write even prose and story wise, you know, and it's just great. And you could do so many things with it, you know, but I always say to myself, yeah, but like what? And every time I watch people do it or watch versions of it, I go, what on earth, you know, is there a Shakespeare anywhere? What? Yeah. I just think like that, you know.
It's very hard to do. I've done a bit of it and I'm not by any means an expert at it. I do actually assign it to actors who I think need to sharpen up their verbal game a little bit. Doesn't mean you have to change how, if you have an accent, I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about vocal technique and sharpness. And it's really hard to do. I mean, if you watch the one who I always just blows me away is Kenneth Branagh.
Oh, yeah, that guy, yeah.
He speaks Shakespeare like that's how he gets up in the morning after he has his coffee and that's how he talks.
Right.
I don't know how he does that. It's like magic to me. It's, you know, but they're, you know, the English are better at that than we are because it's in their culture and it's been in their history for so long. They're just better at it. And they're English actors are generally better verbally.
What about Mel Gibson doing the soliloquy in his Hamlet? Now, let's look at that and then look at whoever else. I don't know what, compare it to any of them.
But Gibson's Hamlet he's a very good actor.
It was okay, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, he's very good and he's, you know, all the politics and all that stuff aside, he's quite good at what he does.
Okay, so he did, but, if you watch, Olivier, now, because Shakespeare through the years hasn't it changed with the changing of acting styles and things?
Well, yeah, we've changed. I mean, I just had Nick Meyer in my class, Nicholas Meyer.
Oh, sure. We know him.
7% Solution.
Sure.
And he directed the Star Trek movie, The Wrath of Khan, and Nick's a brilliant guy. And he's a little older than we are even. I think Nick is in his early 70s, but just absolutely intellectual. Mm. Like, I feel so humbled because I feel like I'm in the presence of somebody way smarter than me.
That's how I often feel with everyone. So there
he was talking about how Olivier was his,
yes.
thing. And I didn't bring it up in class because it didn't, the discussion wasn't going in that direction. I didn't want to derail it. But to me, I don't, it's very cold and very, and I never saw him do it on stage, but right. Shakespeare, but he did do certain performances in film that I loved. Mm. I loved The Entertainer. I loved Sleuth. There's a number of things, but the Shakespeare stuff just, I find it very cold and analytical, but it's of its time. It didn't really, doesn't work for me.
What about Orson Welles? He was a big Shakespearean theater guy.
Genius. I mean, brilliant. I mean, what a talent. My God. Maybe once in a generation or two kind of talent, I think.
Yeah. Good drinker too. Quite a drink.
Good drink. Yeah. Big man. The big man.
Well, you know, we could probably do a whole show just talking about him and things we've heard because, you know, his relationship with Hollywood was skewed, to say the least. Michael Askins with us. The book is, The Authentic Actor. We're never in a million years going to be able to do everything, talk about everything we want to do in one show. So I'm sure if I say, Michael, you're going to be back this year. You'll be back too.
Great.
And we're not done though, because we still have more, to go here, and we're not breaking for any other thing other than, to tell you about the book when you get the book. Now, if you get the book and, you don't, you know, have, like I do, I could call up Michael Askins and say, hey, what about this? What in the book, what do you do if you have a misunderstanding or I'm not saying you didn't write it well. I'm just saying that somebody needs, an auxiliary, these exercises, right? And things. Can one person do with this book alone is what I'm saying.
Well, I don't know that I have a neatly wrapped up answer for that. I think what actors do is they probably look at several books and they take, and some of them take several different kinds of classes as they train. And you know, you get something from, even from a bad teacher, you will get something of value because if for nothing else, then like, oh, I do not want to work in that methodology again. You take something. So I think in this book, one of the comments that I've gotten consistently, and I have to say it really surprised me, but it has been a consistent comment that this book isn't just about acting. This is like about life, and this is about how you approach almost anything. Now, I didn't write it that way. I don't think of it that way, but maybe that's just something about my personality, my approach.
That's interesting because when I was writing the blurb for the blog, I was trying to make people understand, look, there's times in life where you'll have to act. You'll be yourself, but you'll have
Absolutely.
To act. Yeah. And so this is also good for you. You don't want to go and be professional actors. You can learn things because let's face it, a lot of people in general, and the word is always act, isn't it? But you don't know how to act in that situation, right? People don't get it. But your book does have that.
I think it does. And I think, I mean, if for nothing, you know, look, it's an acting book. It's not anything other than an acting book. But people have taken from it. I think one of the things they take from it is that whatever it is that you bring to any situation, whether it's a business meeting or you bring something of yourself, whether you realize it or not, your life walks into the room with you. And so if you're unhappy, but you're trying to act like you're not unhappy and you're pretty good at covering it up, we still know. Mm. We still know at some level, even if we don't consciously know, we still know. If, you know, your mother died when you were 15, you never fully got over it, but you're kind of like faking it. We still know. We don't know maybe specifically what happened, but it. So my point, this is to actors, but I think this is where people have extrapolated it out into a larger thing, is to understand who you are. I mean, this is maybe the most important thing I can help. I can't teach somebody that. And I think you become more of who you are naturally as you get older, if you have any kind of an examined life. But know who you are. Understand what it is that people get from being around you. And you know, sometimes it's very positive, sometimes it's very negative, and understand it. And that is the essence of kind of human interaction. And human interaction is the essence of being on screen. So, I mean, I'm not teaching people how to be somebody else in a play. That's a separate skill set that I love personally. I love doing that kind of work. I love, like, the thing I did, Charles's play, where I really transformed into a into an elderly Holocaust survivor, was a phenomenal challenge, and I hope I did justice to it. But that's a separate kind of skill set that's just so much fun and so challenging. But actually being yourself, which you have to be in film, because the camera does not lie. The camera will pick up something. If there's a whiff of dishonesty, the camera picks that up. That's a challenge. And that, I think, is what people have taken and extrapolated it out into a broader thing. Because a number of people have said, this is really about more than acting. And I mean, I take that as a compliment. That's not what I intended, but it's great.
Well, then it is a different approach. Hemingway said, good writers are good liars. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm, and then when you think of act, and just in an everyday situation, like, you know, people will say, stop acting that way. So that's not really you. You're right. You're doing something else. Why put on an act, which is fake? Now, you're saying that people know those people. Isn't there a way of acting? If nobody knows you, and you, present yourself as something completely different. You act. You could fool them if you're good.
If you're good, that's kind of, right? It's a hard way to go through life.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, well, let's, you know, you take not just, con men. Let's take, evangelists, guys who, you know, decide to sell magic water and, you know, and just appealing to people. Right. And it's like, you really, they're sitting there. No, they want to believe, but we know that. We know that he has the audience.
Yeah,
right?
You're talking about something a little different. You're talking about persuasion.
But it's an act.
It can be. It isn't always, but it certainly can be.
So you have to be a good actor. Not that Peter Popoff can make all these people believe, and then, you know, tonight he could play in Death of a Salesman. Or maybe he can, right? Who knows?
I don't know.
So I'm just saying that I do appreciate the fact, because it is different what you're talking about, and what your book is about is a different approach.
The big aha moment that I had, and it was early on in my film and television journey. I did a recurring character on a show with the great actor Jack Warden. Remember Jack?
Sure. He was in The Verdict. He was great with Paul Newman. Speaking of David Mamet, right?
He was in many things.
Yeah, so many, but I remember that.
Doing a TV series, and I was playing a recurring character.
What was the name of the series? I probably know this.
Crazy before. Like a Fox.
Okay, that was not on very long.
It was on a couple of seasons.
Okay, go.
And Jack... I just wanted to hang around him because, first of all, he was cool. He was fun, and I admired him so much. He was a phenomenally good actor. Mm-hmm. And there was one day, and he was a big sports guy, so whenever I was on the show, I did, I don't know, 3 or 4 episodes, I would gravitate to him. And he was kind to me. He was very nice and supportive and encouraging, actually. And there was one day we were talking – he was a sports guy. We were talking about the Dodgers. We were sitting off to the side of the set. We were shooting something else that we were not involved with, and we were talking about the Dodgers, and he was very exactly as you imagine him to be, you know, an animated, interesting guy. And about, a few minutes into it, the director said, you know, he said, Jack, actually, you are going to be in the shot. We're going to need you. He said, okay, 1 second. He excuses himself, walks over to the set. It's 15 feet from where we're sitting, sits in his chair, does the scene, and I'm looking at this thinking, that's exactly the same guy who was just talking about the Dodgers. Mm. There's no sense of acting. There's no sense of a push, of an outward push. It was the exact same person. And I went, oh, you can do that. You can just be that. Mm. You don't have to put anything on if you're interesting enough. And he was interesting enough. And, you know, maybe it took him 30 years to learn to channel that. But it was a really interesting lesson for me to watch somebody go into a scene who I was just talking to. And he played, you know, he was a very smart actor. He played the scene that he knew where the moments were and he knew how it was supposed to go. But he did it as the exact same guy. Mm. And I thought, that's very interesting. I hope to someday be able to do that.
So we're also talking about, in a sense, characters. We'll watch a movie, or I don't know that much about, in terms of a play, because a lot of people play a role, what have you. Let's just look at a movie. When you look at a movie, like I just mentioned, The Verdict with Paul Newman, and that happens to be David Mamet. Okay, I don't know if he directed it, but anyway, when you see Paul Newman play that role, that's Paul Newman playing that role. If they had switched it and it was someone else, that would be the same words, the same thing, that you'd probably be emitting the same feelings. But when you watch it with Paul Newman, you go, that's that guy, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's, you know, he was a movie star, and that's what movie stars are. They have a certain core presence and quality. I mean, Harrison Ford, when he was a young star, always kind of played a man who was in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. Somebody was after him. You know,
That's right. And he does look like that too.
Tom Cruise, by the way, was a very good actor. You know, people.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, Rain Man, I always said, like, how did they overlook him in Rain Man? He's the main character and he should, I can't believe that they just all looked at, well, I couldn't believe it.
Tom Cruise has a certain quality where he's dead certain about everything. There's no doubt that. He doesn't entertain doubts about anything. He is absolutely his absolute certitude, and that's a very appealing quality for the audience. We go, oh, I love that guy. He's right about everything. So those are core qualities that's what makes them stars.
Right.
And Newman had something else. He had his own thing. Redford had something. You know, today there's not a lot of movie stars. There's a lot of very, very good actors, but there's not a lot of movie stars in that same way. I mean, Clooney, I guess.
What about DiCaprio? DiCaprio would fit. Wouldn't he fit in a movie star type?
Yeah, probably, yes. Yeah, I would say so.
Okay.
But, I mean, the star is somebody, and it's a uniquely cinematic thing. It is not. If the star is a personality with a core quality that we can relate to, that we understand, that is appealing to us, around which the story is built. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't happen in the theater. And so you can't train people for that. And so that's who stars are.
And I like to do it. I like to do, and I tell people, play these games. It's funny, once in a while I like to do it. For instance, let's look at Jackie Gleason in The Hustler, okay?
Oh, amazing.
Right. But and we know that's him and he plays. Okay. But I sit there and I go, what if they gave this to Jackie Leonard? Remember Jackie Leonard? Do you remember him?
Yes, I do.
So now, right, I'm thinking, like, what if Jackie Leonard, he's fat, he could play pool, and he could say lines. That would have been horrible.
But, I mean, Gleason was a terrific actor.
Yes,
He was very good. That's funny.
I like to do that, you know. I it's fun to think of, because let's face it, you know, you always read these, you know, when you read about actors, and they say, like, well, you know, Robert Redford, they thought about Robert Redford for The Godfather. Are you joking? Right? Think about that. Stuff like that. You always hear that. Well, I turned that down. And it turns out, well, everybody's lucky you did. Right?
Yeah. Yes.
Because if we had to remember it with you in it, that's how the brand of that person, and maybe it's not just stardom, because a lot of them weren't stardom. I mean, nobody knew Al Pacino in films. When he did that first one?
Well, and that was, you know, he...
And they wanted it the other way around, remember? They wanted De Niro to play that part.
And they wanted Pacino fired. I mean, it was Coppola who insisted on keeping him. They did not like him, and he's a very, you know... He's one of those actors who's either really good or really not good.
Now, how does that happen? Does he not take personal care for or does he just do junk to phone it in?
I'll tell you exactly how it happens. Because I spent two afternoons with him. What he likes to do is, like, if he's got a project, a movie he's developing, he'll get a group of actors together and they'll read the screenplay with the director there and with Al and other people, and they'll discuss. He wants to hear it out loud, which is a great thing. It's a smart thing to do. And he's developed a number of the movies that he's been in that way. And I got invited to a couple of them, and I read. So I was in the room with him. He's a very, very nice guy, actually. But I could see the issue. And the issue is, he's an actor studio guy. He's totally an actor studio guy, and he's addicted to exploration. So he'll find a moment and he'll explore it 17 different ways, 16 of which don't work. Now, but that's part of the whole actor studio thing. They never, you know, when you plant a flag and you say, this is how it's going to go. He never does that. He is constantly exploring. Now, that's to be admired to some extent. But he never lands on it. And so the work is really inconsistent. Every once in a while, when I had these afternoons with him, when he landed on something right, it was like, wow, that was amazing. But it was very rare. And so he's constantly exploring.
Okay.
And therefore the work is either, you know, it's either amazing or just awful. Apparently, the people who saw, I didn't see it, but I talked to a number of people who saw when he did Glengarry Glen Ross on Broadway just a few years ago, said it was just almost unwatchable.
Really?
So
would he do something different every night? He just keep exploring? Like, every night he'd be something else? Who knows, right? I don't know.
And it's like, that's yeah. not a virtue, you know?
Yeah.
And the thing about acting is, one of the things they don't really talk about, it's a repeatable thing. You have to be able to repeat it. If you're doing Broadway, 8 times a week. If you're doing a movie, you might have 15 or 20 different takes on a scene. Not that it has to be the same, but it has to be kind of the same.
Sure.
Because your castmates are counting on it being a certain way. And when you're doing a movie, the director of photography and they're all counting on it. You know, it's got to fit within a certain matrix that you've already established in let's say the master shot. So yeah, you can reach a point of diminishing returns. And I kind of think that's his methodology. So that would explain to me how wildly uneven his work is, because he's brilliant, and the things he's brilliant in, he's brilliant.
When Anthony Hopkins says acting is easy, you show up, you learn your lines, you show up, you read your lines, and you go home.
He's an Englishly trained actor. He's brilliant.
English, that's right. So what he's saying is not going to work for everybody, right?
No, and I think, you know, part of, again, getting back to my book and getting back to the way I teach, that I don't teach any one methodology. My job is to help you, the actor, discover what organically works for you. Like, this is not rocket science. Everybody who is 4 years old knows how to act. A 4 year old knows how to act. A 4 year old puts on a hat, runs around the house, pretends he's a Power Ranger or whatever, and he's off on some flight of his imagination. And so that impulse is kind of all that acting really is, except you put some rules on it and you put some restrictions on it, but It's not a whole lot more than that. Then it's just developing a technique that kind of works for you every time. I mean, I tend to be more like, I would say, just instinctively like an English actor. English actors tend to work from the outside in rather than the inside out. American actors tend to tear their guts out and sometimes diminishing returns. That's my take on it.
Here's a good idea. And see, if you're into this, we can do this, and we're not done yet. We'll still talk more about the book and acting and what have you. But here, I just had an idea. We'll have you on again. But since this would be demonstrative. Now, the things you said about me, not to make this about me, but I'm the only one here you can deal with right now, and it's my show.
It's all about you, buddy.
Okay, so the deal is this. If you're a director.
Yes.
Okay, and you say, like, you know, I think, because I hear your... You and what you're comfortable doing or what have you, you could play and then give me an idea. Give me a name. Give me a piece. Give me a character. Can't even find the words. From someplace, somewhere. I will get some of that script. I'll get the words. And the next time you're on, I'll learn and work out stuff, and then I'll do this for you. Believe me, one thing great about me that I know about myself is I will fall on my face a million times. It doesn't, I'm not worried about failing. Okay.
That's good.
I can be self-conscious when I'm doing something, but I don't care. I literally do not care. So, and I'm thinking like, well, maybe you'd be the one to do that. And then when they come back and the audience comes back and they're like, well, what have you prepared? Well, the director says I would be a good, you don't have to do this right now. You could email me and say.
I'm thinking.
Unless it comes to you immediately and say, you could probably do, and that would really help. That would help me in a certain way and further serve your book.
The first thing that came to mind, you're going to laugh, but I mean, what the hell? Is that you could be, you know, George Costanza's father in Seinfeld, Jerry Stiller?
Sure, Jerry Stiller.
Frank Costanza. You could be Frank Costanza's army buddy.
Wow. Where would we get that?
I don't know where we would get that.
Well, what character is that like? Costanza's, there a character you thought about who is that person in one of those scenes? I didn't.
No, I'm just making this up because you threw it across the pile there. But you have a natural exuberance. You have a natural animation to your – you are not a shrinking violet, Frank.
No, I guess not.
You've got a great laugh. You've got a great energy. And, you know, if you watch that show – I actually worked on that show. I loved working on
it. Yes. I told a friend of mine who was going to listen, and I said, you know, because that guy, I know, you know, he could, like – there are fans who can recite things from that.
And I never worked – I didn't work with Jerry Stiller, although I had worked with Estelle Harris, who played George's mother, not on that show but on other things.
Mm-hmm.
But there's kind of a manic – intense comedic energy that those two characters had every time. Now, you couldn't watch a whole show about those two characters. You'd want to shoot yourself.
Yeah. And you know what's funny? People say to me, you know, and women have said this to me too, a little Frank goes a long way.
Well,
how do you take that?
It's like putting the spice in the soup. You don't want to put too much spice in, but you need it.
Yeah, you got to taste it, right? Yeah, thank you. I'm just a taste. Well, I would love to, and I would love to do this with myself too. It's like find a character that I could literally work on and understand myself better, and it could, because I really want to understand this. That was the other thing I had when I said, you know, I got to get Michael on again. Why don't I get in touch with him? If he remembers me, I will. We'll, you know, I can learn something. So this is a little journey that's fun.
The big takeaway is. You have to be the best Frank Cotolo you can be. There's only one of you.
Stuck.
There's nobody quite like you. And, you know, I'm joking, but I'm quite serious. I always say to actors, you know, your job is to find something in this material you've been given that no one else is going to find, that only you're going to find because it's your unique take on it. Not everybody is that blessed by being that unique. There's a lot of people who are very kind of generic.
And some of them are good actors, though. Right?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, of course.
You're very unique. You're a very spicy flavor.
But where do I find, see, that's why I'm asking you. Like, we could find something.
You're never going to find anything. You're never going to find a part as interesting as you are. So you have to write it.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
yeah. You have to create something. That'll be our next show.
Okay, that'll be it. Then I will do this because I am a writer. I'm confident in myself as a writer. So
put yourself in a situation. It can be serious. It can be comedic. Right. It can be.
So I write a monologue is what I'm doing.
Yeah. And it can be, you know, when you're as specific as you are, and I'm saying this to you, but I would say this to an actor.
Sure.
I had this one guy. He was a very, kind of a crazy guy. He was a New York guy, and he was always being told. He said, "Actually," he said, "the acting teachers I've had have always told me to lose my accent. He had a very, very thick accent. I said, why? That's who you are. I mean, like, what, so you're going to be Ronald Coleman? I mean, what? And I said, no, you are that guy, and that's what you will be used for. Now, within that, you develop a range. Right. You develop, your range may be narrow, but within that range, like I say, you look at John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, they had a narrow range, but within that, they played everything. Mm-hmm. They played any kind of character imaginable within a very narrow range. So it's, the difference between being transformative, like Daniel Day-Lewis was in Lincoln, the opposite of that is to be informative, and to be informative of yourself. Inform the character with who you are.
Well, that's where I get confused, because if I choose something that's already written and I want to be me in that character, it's going to be incorrect, isn't it? Because it's going to be in the context of everything.
Look, it's going to be just the way you would do it. I always, here's another, I'm repeating all these little sayings I've developed. When you hear the blues, everybody, after you've heard the blues for 15 seconds, you know
the blues.
You recognize the structure of it.
Right.
You recognize how the phrases repeat and all that. It's like, it's a really simple structure. Mm-hmm. So what makes the blues interesting is that B.B. King plays it differently than Buddy Guy, right, who plays it differently than Eric Clapton. And what they do is they brand it with something that is unique to them. It's just like what actors do. So I'm telling you, you could read anything as Frank Cotolo and make it interesting, and not, you just disabuse yourself of the notion that you have to be somebody else.
That's great. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to write something, and I'm going to bring a couple of other lines from, I'm going to look through stuff that I like, and I'll bring some stuff and I'll read for you, and I'll put Frank Cotolo in, and I'll try not to be too self-conscious and understand it.
I have a guy in my class, mm-hmm, who's, you're going to love this. He's 81 years old.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And his name is Herb Astro, which I think is one of the great names of all time. And Herb is a New Yorker. Herb is a Brooklyn guy. He grew up in New York. He studied acting quite seriously as a young man in New York in the 1950s, I think, back when people took things, you know, quite seriously. And then he had a wife and kids, and he had a business, and he got out of it. And he had came to see the show that I did, that show I told you about that, mm-hmm, Charles wrote.
Right.
And he said, I want to be in your acting class. And I said, you're in. Great. I knew him a little bit before in another, I was in Jeffrey Tambor's class, and Herb was in there. And he's a guy, not unlike yourself, who's very, very specific, very hard for him to be somebody else. And I just said, you don't have to be anybody else. You just take who you are, and not every piece of material is going to suit you. That's true.
Right.
And you're not going to find anything that's necessarily as interesting as you. So write it. So write something for, mm-hmm, yourself, or you might find something that seems to fit that you feel comfortable doing. But you know, we're not interested in perfect. I'm not. I'm interested in imperfect.
Mm.
And you're highly imperfect. And, no, but that's the best way to be.
Okay. It just sounds so great. It sounds so funny.
I didn't mean it to sound that way, but I mean,
it's okay. I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, you're a jumble of imperfections, as we all are, and you're immediately identifiable vocally, and so that's, you take that and run with it, and you can tune that into anything, into any kind of material, including Shakespeare.
I don't know about traditionally, but maybe you're right. Maybe Frank Cotolo could be the fool in King Lear.
Yeah, forget traditional. Who cares?
Yeah, exactly. I see what you're saying. And what's great about that, I think everyone may agree with, especially this day and age. I mean, there was a time when rules were rules. And as you were talking about in the 50s and 40s, when people did, right, there were certain ways people wanted you to do things, even in the arts, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's kind of gone away.
Gone.
I mean,
it's very gone.
Yeah, it's very gone. So I think it's kind of the Wild West. You can do whatever you want to do, but you know, what despite what remains in place is that good is good, great is great, bad is still bad. And usually it has to do with whether you're understanding what it is you're doing. It has nothing to do with who you are. Who you are is just there, and it is the flavor of the soup and of the stew. And you just accept it, and you go with it, and you embrace it. And then, you approach the material as anybody would approach the material.
When did you have you a paragraph or a half a minute or a minute of something you wrote for yourself? You have it sitting in your desk there or something?
No, I don't, because I really haven't. I have in my head Charles's play, because I learned that thing, and it'll never leave me.
Oh, that why don't you do something? I'm asking you to perform.
That's all right.
You'll change, because you're going to change. Right, like I should worry. He's an actor. You do, I don't know, whatever. Do one piece or, one beginning, okay. Middle, end thing, and then we'll just describe you're a Jewish Holocaust.
He's a Jewish Holocaust survivor. He's 90 years old. He's in his antique shop in New York.
An antique shop, right? Okay.
In 1990, and what happened? The setting, just so you understand it, is that this greedy real estate developer, not unlike our next president, wants to force him out of his shop.
Okay.
And he's not going to go anywhere. He's been pushed around his whole life. He was in Auschwitz. Come get me.
Okay.
He's not going to go anywhere. So because 60 Minutes does a piece on him, and his phone is ringing off the hook. He's got his 15 minutes of fame. Everyone wants to talk to him. And as he comes into his shop at night, there's a young woman in his shop, and he thinks she's the handyman who's got to fix the wiring. And she says, "No, I'm from People magazine. We had an interview." And he says, "I do not keep a clock or any calendar. I will not allow them in the shop. I am too aware of time as it is, Miss Carbuncle. That is a very unusual name. Say that again, please." "Ah, Carmichael. Miss Carmichael. Much nicer. Sit, Miss Carmichael." So she sits down. And the phone's ringing. He can't answer the phone. So finally he gets to the point where she asks him if an old gramophone that he has there works. He says, "Does it work?" He says, "Of course it works. It's just old like me, but it works." So he cranks up the gramophone and plays this beautiful Viennese music. He says, "Ah, you see, that is the sound of my childhood. That is my earliest memory. That and the marvelous aroma of strudel coming from the kitchen. So we're starting now." "Good, good. So, I was born in Vienna in 1900, what you might call a child of the century. My father was a doctor, very distinguished, Wilhelm Altmann. He taught at the university. He was married to a very ugly woman. She was not my mother. She was my brother Max's mother. Oh, poor Max. Always the hard luck case. Max's mother drowned in the Danube in 1898 on a pleasure cruise." You have to laugh, right? "On a pleasure cruise. My father was not too unhappy. You know, there is no great joy in being married to an ugly woman. But then he met my mother, Sonia, who was a great beauty and a great deal younger than my father. Here's a picture. Look at, I painted this from memory. This is my father, my mother, and Max. Oh, yeah, that little boy there, that is me, yeah. You like it? Good. Well, thank you. Well, you know, all her life, Sonia, my mother, wanted to be in the arts, but she never succeeded. Ah, you see? You see, failure is genetic. But she surrounded herself with artists, musicians, composers, and as a little boy, I loved to draw." And he goes on and on. This is an hour and a half play.
That's whoever that might be. What technical information have you absorbed through the years to know the Jewish guy from New York? I mean, you just can't do him. Some guy,
well,
right?
He's not really a Jewish guy from New York. He's a Jewish guy from Vienna.
Okay.
Then went to Auschwitz, who then lived in Israel, then lived in South America, who lived in Chicago.
But you know the dialect. You know, I mean, I could do it just from, you know, people, you know, Jewish tailors and next door people in New York where I grew up. Sure. But it wouldn't sound like you've really grasped the entire dialect.
Well, yeah, and it was hard to find the voice because he's not, you know, there's the New York Jewish thing, which is Eastern European kind of shtetl, yeah. Poland, yeah. Lithuania, kind of, those are my people personally. Mm. This guy is Viennese, so he's a little different. So he doesn't say oi, he'll say ah. And, the greatest part of it, if we have a minute.
I got a minute, go for it.
Where he says, this is the heavy part. It's actually quite buoyant and charming, but it gets heavy. And he says, I'm trying to remember the start of this part, Frank, where he says, he says, so I was away. I was out of the country on business when Hitler invaded Austria. And, my father-in-law was a man of lightning quick decisions. He put Rivka and the children on the first boat to America and he promised I would follow immediately. And when I returned and when I learned of this, I was incensed at this needless desertion. Look, you have to understand something. In those days, there were many intelligent people who did not take Hitler seriously. You see, we did not have the benefit of rational retrospect. We thought we were safe. We were Viennese Jews with money. What did it matter who the government was? So you paid a little more to the man at the top. So I wrote to Rivka in America demanding she come home at once, and I never heard back from her. And shortly after that, my father-in-law's business was seized. He fled to Switzerland, and I was arrested by the Nazis. And they sent me to Theresienstadt, which was the showplace for the Third Reich. It's where all the artists were sent, you see. And they would take the Red Cross through inspections, and they would say, look how well we treat our Jews. Look, they have their own cafe. They have their own money. Look how happy they are. Lying bastards. So from Theresienstadt, we were shoved into boxcars and we were sent to Auschwitz. Now you have read, you have seen the photos, you have heard the stories. You cannot imagine. You know, the guards, there were men and women and one could not tell the difference. And then one day I saw her. Fräulein Kurtz was one of the guards. She finally had found the discipline she had hungered for. I prayed to God she would not recognize me. What a joke that was. Who would recognize a skeleton? I do not know how long I was there before. I encountered a woman who had been in my dancing class years before in Vienna. She says to me, how she recognized me, I will never know. I was born, I was decay, I was dead inside already 100 years waiting to be buried. She says, Franz Ortmann, how can this be? Just your front. Your mother is here. My mother is here. Yeah, so I started to cry, you know, and listen. I had been through what I had been through. If this was to be my fate, so be it. But this was not for her, not for my beautiful little mother. So one night when it was dark, they snuck me into the women's quarters and they said, do not be shocked. You see, a female guard had beaten her badly because she could not keep up with the other prisoners. So I said, Mama, she was frail and gray. I held her in my arms and I said, Mama, and she put her fingers up to my broken lips and ever so faintly I heard her say to me, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. So do you understand now, Miss Carmichael? You understand? I will not sell this shop. I will not. That's the end of the first act.
That is so terrific. I went a little over time. I could not. I didn't have the heart to stop you. That is great. And you are certainly a thespian. Of the higher command. I don't know whatever I want to say there. But Michael, I got to run here now. But listen, you're going to be on again. The book is The Authentic Actor, or the business and
the art and business of being yourself.
There you go. I didn't even try it. Michael, we will talk off mic and what have you again, and I'll do this and I'll find something and we'll have more fun and we'll get Charles on it. We'll just it'll be okay.
Thank you, Frank. This was fun.
Thank you. I told you it'd go quickly. Look at this, huh? Okay.
All right.
Good night, Michael.
All right. Take care.
Michael Laskin. And why even do our song? For those of you listening live, ladies and germs, here come I'll leave you because no theme. That's right. Because I have nothing. We'll see you next week. I have nothing more to say.